Welcome to Mew. Today's episode is with Locke Kelly. Locke is a meditation teacher, a licensed psychotherapist, is the author of Shift Into Freedom, as well as The Way of Effortless Mindfulness, and is also the founder of the Effortless Mindfulness Institute. Locke comes from the perspective that awakening is a natural and potential stage of human development. So as we go from being pre-rational infants to being rational adults, there's also the opportunity and capacity for awakening to be a further stage of development and growth. The way or primary practice that Locke sees this being realized is through many small glimpses many times throughout our ordinary lives in order to integrate and abide in the awakened perspective. So this episode is all about the nature of suffering, what freedom from suffering consists of. We get into the stages of awakening, what different paths to awakening might look like. And Locke provides some really fun and pragmatic pointing out instructions for shifting into and abiding in awakened awareness. Locke is one of my favorite meditation teachers. I love his style and approach to awakening as it's super fun and accessible. I've listened to the audiobook for Shift Into Freedom several times and have found it to be an absolute core and foundational part of my ongoing practice and understanding. So if you're interested, I highly recommend checking any of his books out as they're super good and clarifying for what awakening is and how it is that one might shift into that level of freedom. And so with that, I'm very happy to be bringing you this interview with Locke Kelly. So this is a question that I've been asking my guests recently, and I'm also curious what your take on it is. But what is suffering? What is the nature of suffering? What produces suffering?
Yeah, so that's a great question, and it has many levels. And I think you could just define it physically, emotionally, existentially, spiritually. Yeah, suffering, I think it starts with pleasant and unpleasantness, something that's unpleasant or not wanted or almost chronic in its fact that it doesn't seem to be coming and going, doesn't seem to be going away. So something painful, sharp pain, stepping on a tack and then pulling the tack out might be painful, but not suffering. So suffering would be if it gets infected and then there's kind of a chronic pain equals suffering. So kind of ongoing. I think that's one simple way of starting the conversation about what is suffering. And then I'll jump to the other side, which is the deepest level maybe might be that suffering is a kind of identification with a limited sense of who we are. And because that constellation of consciousness that we are operating within, almost like a computer program, is looping upon itself, and it can't see other dimensions that are subtler and wider, more loving, more connected. It feels disconnected and is caught in kind of a level of scanning for danger, looking for problems, and then feels that limited perspective is there's something wrong, there's something not right, and it kind of grabs on to the negative view of the problem, which then starts to kind of perpetuate in the mind or in consciousness, and like a storm cloud kind of becomes pervasive, and we take ourselves to be that storm cloud.
Does resistance, contraction, and immersion in thought, and then also this mistaken case of identity that you just explained, do these fit into your understanding and perspective of suffering?
A little bit, though. I know kind of I've heard these from other people, and I don't quite agree with them. It's not resistance to thought, because thought to me is mental sensations. In other words, when we look at an fMRI, we realize you cannot stop thoughts. You know, thoughts are happening all the time, so there's no way to resist them. Then we get to identification with them. And certainly, even when we functionally need to do something in the world, we have to identify with thought and duality and driving a car and avoiding an object. It is more about the collapse of thought into a thinker. You know, the I think, therefore I am becomes the problem, as if. So thinking is not a problem. Thinking is a tool. In Buddhism, thinking is considered the sixth sense. So we have a regular five senses, which we all know. And then thinking is just a way of organizing information. And in itself is never a problem. So whether you're resisting it or not resisting it, or even utilizing it, or even absorbed in it for a while you're in a task and really figuring something out, that can actually be joyful. So it's really this self-referencing of thought going to thought that creates a small constellation of consciousness, which we call like an ego center or a small self, that then feels like me and primarily me, and then is limited in its view. Within that little view, then people are like, well, try to accept everything as it is, or try to not resist thought. But that's like a little game within that identity, which in the kind of effortless mindfulness approach, you can actually literally shift out of in a moment, rather than trying to clean up the cloud of your mind and not resist and accept everything and try to replace positive thoughts with negative and do all those things, which can relatively be helpful or even be mindful of what's coming and going, that you can literally disidentify or detach or let go or unhook from that cloud with awareness, become aware of the more primary, spacious, and pervasive awareness, which includes thoughts and even a thinker part of us. But the key is that we've shifted, where are we aware from? Who's aware of the thoughts and the thinker?
How do you see the stages of awakening? Most of us are spending quite a bit of time, or almost all of our time, in ego identification, so belief in the mind and body as self, the sense of awake awareness being identified with the thinker. So you get like the localization of identity either in like the center of the chest or the head. There also seem to be stages beyond perhaps identification with witness consciousness or awake awareness. So could you summarize the movement from ego identification to beyond?
Yeah. I mean, certainly just to say in the beginning, I mean, I have approaches that I enjoy and ones that have worked for me, but there are many different ways of unfolding to, you know, kind of travel the unfolding that can look a little different. There's different doorways or practices initially as ways in, through which different people, different learning styles, and people have different obstacles can try to bang their head against one style of practice. And if they just shift over a little bit, it's like, oh, that's easy. Why didn't you just say that before? Sitting still, not moving, watching, you know, it can be good for some people, and others it's just likely will never work, or at least not very quickly. So that's just to say that it's not one way or one path. So I'll just talk about, you know, a specific one that I've been seen and felt evolve and watched others, and then it's certainly related to certain traditions. So yeah, it seems that there's kind of a developmental psychological way of looking at it, which is basically that we're in a developmental stage as a baby, where we're dependent and we can give it from different developmental theories. Freud called it primary process, and then we go to school, develop secondary process, which means conceptual thinking or different ways of understanding that. So once we go from dependency, we do, at a year and a half, a child develops what's called, interestingly, self-awareness in psychology, which means the ability to split off and see that you're a subject and there are objects in the world and that you're an object. So it can look in the mirror and see. Before that, it can't see that there's a mark on its nose. Like, but then at that time, it goes like, oh, that's me. And I go like that. And then the child at that age also says, internalizes language and says, oh, you shouldn't touch the hot stove. So it's like, all of a sudden, it's split off into, I shouldn't touch the hot stove, to a voice that's self-awareness that says, you shouldn't touch the hot stove because it's internalized. So that process of creating an identity then becomes reinforced with culture and education and kind of the individuation from dependency to be able to learn tasks and to survive in the world physically, emotionally, intellectually, to be able to work and be independent. But then that usually stops there. So then, seeing this as a developmental process, awakening is seeing that, oh, that identity as a thinker, a doer, a worker, a person who's trying to be successful and smart and fast and maybe good, maybe not good, but at least happy in the relative understanding of being an animal and a human creature who can think and make choices, as if there's another stage. Like that's, and just like other stages, that still remains. There's still, you know, the thoughts and the conditioning and the emotions. Then this is the new possibility that there is already. So in the direct practice traditions, Mahamudra, Dzogchen, some Advaita, Taoism, mystical versions, contemplative versions of Christianity, Judaism, and just general contemplative or consciousness traditions, the direct practice tradition is there's a consciousness or an awareness that is prior to thought, is what thought is made of, and is beyond thought, meaning that it's transpersonal and it's already here and installed and available as a new operating system to which thoughts and doing can now be done, but from a whole different feeling of who you are and where you're aware from. And main markers are, there's kind of a awakening from that small self. And then some people stop at that next stage, which is, I'm awakening from, therefore there's no self, as if that's it. So just seeing through the small self, being headless or being void or being centerless, is the goal. And then some of those traditions trust, okay, well, it'll just unfold, you know, from there, or that's enough, or just the freedom from. So then the tradition I'm in is saying, okay, that's a stage. And initially you go from knowing to not knowing, but then you go to the not knowing that knows. In other words, that the question is, if you're not a self, if you're not a thinker, where are you aware from? What's the feeling and the intelligence from which you can get up off of the cushion and or the chair and go do something? Or do you have to just realize that intellectually or existentially, and then you still operate from where? That's the question. So that sometimes is not answered, but in this more Mahamudra tradition, which is kind of the sense, is there's awakening from that awareness, then awakening to recognize the awake consciousness that's aware without referring to thought, but can use thought. Then there's awakening to a realization that that's who we are, or that's the most essential nature, is that being. And then the next stage of unfolding seems to be, what's the relationship between that kind of pure awareness where some systems stop and say, those systems would say, I am the pure awareness, everything else is illusion. I am the pure awareness, like a movie screen, everything else is coming, going, it's just not real, it's a movie. Whereas this next stage is called same taste. So what that means is the awareness and the aliveness, the ultimate reality and the relative reality are not two. So they taste the same and they taste like awareness. So that you start to feel awareness is arising as energy dynamically, then it forms into patterns like your body and everyone else and everything else in the world, like planets and trees and couches. And then there's some connection of same, same. There's some sense that you're not caught in this, what I call the witness protection program, of that kind of middle stage of being not the old me only, as if that's it. I'm no self. It's like, then you're, okay, you're no self. Okay, you're not that self, but that doesn't mean you're no self. It doesn't mean there's nothing, meaning void only. There is void. You've discovered it. And now what's this? So that relationship, right? So that's a question. It seems like a lot of people don't want to answer because they're just like, I got no self.
Hanging out in emptiness.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just.
It's so nice.
Yeah. And so interestingly, even emptiness has a couple different definitions. So emptiness, as the no self group says, they think of it as void. Emptiness means a little more like Western, like that's a thing. I think I'm a thing. Now I'm no thing. I'm nothing. Emptiness. Whereas another definition of emptiness is actually comes from the original Theravada Vipassana insight tradition. It says that you're empty of being a separate self. Everything is empty of being a separate thing. Therefore, the next statement is, therefore it's interdependent. Therefore it's interconnected. Therefore that unity or that sameness, that not sameness, but same that's different, rises as difference, but that interdependence, interconnection, is that feeling of freedom that allows you to be a human being, but not be only a separate self and not be caught in, I am the pure awareness and I walk into a grocery store and things end up in my cart because there's no doer, there's no free will, which I've heard many times. And I always ask them, okay, one quick question. What is in your cart? Are they things you tend to like, or are they random objects? So that fullness coming back home. So like opening from the small self to the pure awareness, recognizing, then realizing you are the awareness primarily, and then feeling this interconnection with aliveness and embodiment. And then kind of the last stage is often open-heartedness, some kind of feeling when you feel this interdependence, emptiness as interdependence, you feel kind of a fabric of love or okayness, well-being, it starts as maybe a little bliss, but kind of feels like everything's okay, nothing can be harmed, essentially. So there's a safety that we've all been looking for. When we're a separate animal, we're always a little on guard because the threat of potential harm, emotionally and physically. So that's kind of a little, that's an unfolding kind of within consciousness, within the unfolding of awakening.
A few things stand out to me. One thing that caught my attention was when you brought up one taste, something I've also been exploring that doesn't work for me. I don't know why. Actually, I have some ideas why, but so there's sort of the more pragmatic Dharma school way of going about this, which is also more of a Vipassana-based approach, which is moving towards awakening through the perspective of the meditator, at least at first, which involves a tremendous amount of body scanning and noting. And so this path is meant to objectify everything such that it produces defabrication, which can be achieved skillfully through ascending jhanas, getting cessations, and getting insight through high levels of meditative absorption. And this word, like annealing, like the joy anneals the brain, allowing it to be malleable and susceptible to insight, to be prone to insight.
So what anneals the brain is the joy. Where did the joy come from? The joy is,
say, like the first jhana, okay, or second jhana.
Right, gotcha.
So that's like one approach, and that approach drives me crazy, which is why I like your approach so much. In that approach, there is, sometimes it's talked about, at least in terms of the people that I hang out with, in terms of first, you know, you make it to the witness stage, the witness protection program. And then there's a sense of identifying as everything. And then there's a sense of identifying as nothing. And then there is something more non-local that comes after that, which is sometimes described as fourth path. And it sounded like that was what one taste was in Mahamudra, or the traditions that you speak to, where the phenomena are self-cognizing. And the boundary of mind, there's no more boundary of mind. So everything is self-cognizing where it is non-locally. So I'm curious if that's, you know, the same thing as one taste. And then if you could also give your perspective on the Vipassana path and the defabrication that comes for that, and then the pointing out instruction path, where we're already noticing what's true, and you know, how that all relates.
Yeah. I mean, I think they both can get there through different ways. I mean, in some ways you could say it's an interesting, in Christian theology, they talk about two paths called via negativa and via positiva. So it just means the way of negation and the way of going directly to the positive, go to the divine right away, or dissolve or deconstruct everything. So I think that's really the best way, simplest way, just to understand that. Like, okay, this method, the Vipassana method, if you follow it out, it's deconstructing everything. It's seeing that you're not a self, then it's seeing that thoughts come and go, then it's seeing that there is no inherent existence in anything. And at some point, you have to get to who's seeing that. So you, as you say, you have to establish a mindful meditator, a mindful witness, in order to see that. And my sense of what that is that I call it a transitional subject. So rather than being an I, you know, that in developmental psychology, they have transitional objects, like a blanket for a kid, you know, who walks around. But this is a transitional subject, is a meditator or a mindful witness, which is better than the regular subject. You know, it's a good. And then the question is, how do you proceed from there? At some point, whether you use jhanas or you use just super fast dissection of everything, so you're watching it moment, 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 but still it's like, who's watching it? You have to let go or make that move from observer to being everything, universal, at some point, which in that path, they say, just happens naturally through that, because you're doing it, it just unwinds itself. And then similarly, the metaphor of negation or doing nothing in Advaita and Zen, the Zen quote that I like is, muddy water, let stand, becomes clear. So that's that approach. It's basically, don't do anything, just sit there, do shikantaza. So Vipassana does the analytic deconstructing, the Zen just like, don't move, just sit there. Will you have a stick? No, but I mean, they just try to not identify, not analyze, not label, not just, don't do that. Don't, you just not identifying with conditioning until it settles down. And then the third way is this direct recognition, which requires the premise, okay, that clear water or clear sky is the easier metaphor. Clear sky is here. We're trying to deconstruct the cloud. So we'll switch from water to a cloud. So let the stormy cloud let it settle becomes clear, or analyzing the cloud and all its parts that it's not me opens up to the sky. So the direct path is have awareness that's in the cloud, that's already who we are. The key is to make that switch right away. I mean, that's kind of the hidden radical assumption. It seems to be the radical assumption is the awake consciousness, the freedom, the love we're seeking, the truth, the reality is already here, fully available, this far away, just a moment away. The second is only that awareness can know itself. So then the third one is, okay, I'm talking to you, the awareness, and you, the awareness, can unhook from being identified and go home. Go look and find it and be it and then include everything. And often, you know, what happens? Yeah, so those are the three.
Okay. I feel like I have been caught in the witness protection program until like just a second ago. So it's funny you also talk about like, oh, like, why didn't you just say it like that? Right. So there's like the phenomenological sense of self, right? So there's like this fuzzy cloud thing. And usually you're just immersed in that. There's the shift where without knowing how you do it, like step back and you can objectify that thing. But then I can like notice that in the act of objectifying that thing, then there's the reification of the sense of witness consciousness. And then when you like let go of that, then it's just groundlessness, which I could notice that there was fear, yes, and lack of orientation.
Right. That's right.
But then that seems to cut straight through to closer to the sense of like one taste. I feel like I just realized that in the last 2 years of my life, I've been hanging out in, I know I've been hanging out in the witness state, right. But
yeah. And it's also not a, you know, I'm willing to be a little blunt in order to be clear, but I don't want to seem like that's a bad thing and people shouldn't do it. It tends to be a natural, if you go step by step, you're going to be there for certain amount of time, even if it's just 3 seconds, once you do the unhooking and opening and recognizing, realizing, being aware from, as, and then include everything, there's a kind of a, oh, I'm aware, what am I interconnected with? They have a practice called, it's called, interestingly, they call it the mixing practice, mixing awareness with aliveness, but you're actually not mixing because it's already mixed, but recognizing the mixing. And it's also called the nailing practice, but it doesn't mean hammer and nail. It means like a gymnast nailing it. Like, so what,
okay,
what you do is you just hang out as the pure awareness, the witness, and then you just curiously become aware. All right, what's the next vibration or sensation or energy that's arising? And then rather than being separate as the sky, which is where choiceless awareness or big sky mind or open attention, there's different pure Advaita people call non-dual awareness, even though it's actually not dual awareness, but it's not non-dual because in Buddhism, at least, non-dual means there's not two. But in non-dual awareness, there's two. There's awareness and then there's this other stuff that's coming and going. So as the pure awareness, as the witness, you're just curious, all right, what's this next vibration? Is it separate or is it made of awareness? And you just hang out. You're not too worried about what it, but as soon as it recognizes itself as both ultimate and relative, it just goes like, oh, wow. Then you have one taste or same taste. So that's kind of the move that very few will, that's kind of a very small teaching, even within like Ma Mudra and Dzogchen and other, you know, it's like they just skip over that. A lot of people will get it directly and then like be back and be kind of embodied, but they don't, it's hard to teach that. How do you get from witness consciousness to same taste? That's one way.
That was really good.
Yeah.
The experience I notice is that the, don't know. So like, I'm looking at you, but it feels like me as consciousness is moving as you talking to.
Yes, that's it.
Itself. It's, this is like the, yeah.
That's exactly it. And that's the thing is that, so there, just in that, what you said is the both, because it doesn't mean there's not subject object on one level. There's the me that's looking at you, that's the same as me and you, and there's me looking at you, that's also the same as me and you. So there's not two, but there's two. So that's the key. It's a paradox. It's not, it's both and, the non-dual, the reason they didn't use nothingness and they didn't use oneness. They have the word oneness in Sanskrit. So it's not one and it's not nothing. It's not pure awareness. They have a word, turiya, and other words for pure awareness. Non-dual means not two. Well, what are the two? The two are the ultimate and the relative, or the awareness and the aliveness, or the divine and the immanent. So that's the thing, is what's the relationship? And when they're related, they're like a infinity symbol. They're paradoxically both at the same time. That's the one taste. So one taste isn't just like everything is tastes like awareness. It is awareness. It's like vanilla ice cream. No, it's like it still has its individuality and unique appearances. But there's that, what you just said, that same on the level of awareness, not on the level of subtle body energy, which some people get merged with other people. You know, like, oh, we're the same. Oh, you know, empathetically merged. It's not that. But it's on another level of same. Does that make sense?
Yes, very clearly, and also conceptually, no, because I'm not really hanging out there right now.
Right. You're not a mergy type. Most people are either more head types or more emotional, energetic types, or they're shutdown types. They're just shut down both the head and their heart. They're kind of very concrete. You and I are probably start with head types. And so we got to get embodied and open-hearted, whereas a lot of people are energetically like walking into a room and they just feel, oh my God, that person I'm staying away with. And I'm like taking on this person's really sad. And they're like taking on this stuff. So that's a certain type of person that tries to feel connected and the same and get out of the separate sense of self through emotional energy, through subtle body energy.
Sorry, they try to do what through subtle body energy?
They try to get out of that sense of being separate and connect to others.
I see.
And find a kind of love and oneness and connection.
Prior to one taste.
Prior to one taste, yeah. It's subtle body.
I see.
Subtle body energy, yeah.
I see. So we move from ego identification to witness consciousness. And then once we can let go of witness consciousness, for me, it just felt like I just let go of it. And then there's a sense of groundlessness. There's sort of like a bit of fear comes up, actually, like a sense of parts reaching to hold something.
Yes, that's it.
And then if you just stay with it, then usually for me, it's like most, like the glimpses I've had in the past, or it's most active with like people, where like the person is self-cognizing, person made of consciousness, knowing itself, speaking like as me to me. And then from that level, you know, a head focused person from that perspective, you know, is then going to do more heart-based practices, whereas someone who's more subtle energy oriented would learn maybe boundaries.
Yeah, they have to learn kind of to go beyond energy. Same thing for both, that you have to learn to go beyond thought for head-based people, and you have to learn to go beyond energy to pure awareness. So both have to find out, oh, there's something that's pure that's not energetic and it's not mental.
I see.
Yeah.
And since those are contents.
Yeah, that's right. Because those are contents and those are still relative level. Those are the subtlest relative level is energy, vibration, sensation, even before forming into words or feelings or emotions, is just vibrational level of perception. So any of the five senses, any of the six senses, including thought. Whereas the key is, can you go for 3 seconds to 3 minutes out of your mind out of your body, meaning out of your senses, beyond your senses, to the awareness that feels no pain, is unbound, timeless, and just shift to this, which is always been here and isn't dissociated, although that's the, all the parts of you will say you're dissociating, or you're, watch out, danger, you're out of your mind, you're, there's no way you could respond if a tiger comes in the room, but you're actually alert to awareness itself, and then you go into, you know, that it's not quite nirvikalpa samadhi, it's actually kind of pure awareness. And then as you come back, that remains 51% primary. And then everything else, energy, thoughts, feelings, sensations, is included as the arising, like an ocean of awareness arising as your body and mind and emotions and world. So that's the shift, like a background foreground shift is one way to, or from gross to subtle and then back to gross.
So I don't think that I got that one. Is that a movement from one taste?
That's should be prior to one taste. So it should be one step beyond witness consciousness. So you could say, almost like you described, you make what I call the first magic move of mindfulness, which is step out of being identified with thought and be an observer of contents, right? So that's like a mindful witness, right? So that's something that even people who are doing mindfulness, most of them are just watching their breath and doing shamatha, and then they do loving kindness meditation. But even though they're calling it mindfulness, they're not doing the four foundations of mindfulness, which are mindfulness of thoughts, mindfulness of feelings, mindfulness of sensations, and then of what's called mind objects. That move to see that, and that there is no solid self, sense of self, and that the arising of the thought, I am thinking this thought, is not me. it's a movement of a playing of a recording that is playing, and then you've moved the observer to this first step of looking. You know, I always ask people, like, where are you mindful from? And they're like, what do you mean? What, like, here or here or here? But once you feel it, wherever it is, I'm on the right side of my head looking. It's okay. So then you pull the camera back to a mindful witness. You kind of feel back like, oh, wait a minute. It's not just in one point of view. There's a big sky mind. There's a choiceless awareness. There's a vast non-dual awareness that's aware of contents coming and going through the sky, birds and clouds. So then the next move is not to keep pulling back till you get to infinity, but to have awareness look back through the camera. Who's behind the camera? You have to pop, kind of pop the witness or pop the observer and go right to the awareness that's equally spacious and pervasive. So it's no longer out that way. It's everywhere. It's within the cloud. So you move back, you see the cloud, you are the cloud. You see the contents of the cloud. Now you see the sky, the birds, all the clouds. Now you don't just look to the universe, but you just open up back and or back through this way. And then everything lands as contentless, timeless. So the subject and the object is awareness.
That's a difficult one. I'm not sure that I got that one. How does that fit into being like after the witness state? Is that a remedy for the head versus subtle energy based person?
Yeah, I mean, that is really the what some people call non-dual awareness or pure awareness. You know, so I do a bunch of different pointers and glimpses to experience that. And it doesn't have to be so huge. So just in a short little way, just you know, if you feel what's going on in your body, you feel, you know, whether there's a little physicalness, there's a little sleepiness or energy, or you're just observing without changing. Just observe what's going on in your body. A little contact with physical form, with the chair, you feel pressure, you feel sleepy or agitated or energized or some emotion. And you're just noticing it, just kind of labeling, oh yeah, that's what that is, that's what that is. And then same with your mind or your brain. Any worry or thoughts coming and going, pleasant, unpleasant, tired, pain. And now just not changing anything, just shift to be interested in what's aware of your body and mind. So let the awareness be the subject and the object exclusively, just for a few seconds, and just notice there is no sleepiness. As awareness, there's no pain, there's no worry, nothing coming and going, just isness or awareness. And then as that awareness, just include your body and mind while remaining primarily viewing from spacious and pervasive awareness that's contentless, timeless, boundless, but here. Did you get a second of just that teasing out? So what I did is usually awareness and contents are pretty close. Even when you look at them, you're still like a little connection. There's a little, even as observer, there's a little like, look at that, look at that, look at that. And then, so this way we're like, okay, let's see what contents are. Let's see emotions, thoughts, pleasant, tired, feeling, agitated, worried. Yeah, okay, good. Now that's fine. That's what's happening here. Now what, let's look at those, let's look at those. Have awareness just make itself the whole thing. Just for a moment, be uninterested in contents and feel how different the awareness is, because it has no worries, no fear, no anxiety, no, it's never been tired, never been in pain, pure awareness. It's no suffering. And then as that primary dimension of who you are, which is awake, which is nirvana, then include, without going either or, as that, let's see if it arises as sensation that has pleasant and unpleasant, as a nature of human conditioning, it has, as a nature of human experience, is it's going to be pleasant and unpleasant and feelings and thoughts and particularities, but don't go back and create a small sense of self or a point of view observer as a meditator. Feel like the whole thing is connected, like you and I are connected and unique. Yeah.
I'm a little bit confused about this one and squaring it with the one taste, that one taste experience, which is very clear to me.
Yeah. So the one taste. I mean, just to say that in order to get one taste and make sure it's not subtle body energy, because if you drop out of your mind, you go, oh, you're kind of in subtle body energy. You're out of your head. You're in kind of dancing, mergy feeling, but you haven't cleaned it out. So what that move is, just to be clear before you comment, is that one taste is after you realize you're awake awareness, and that you realize as awake awareness, everything's made of awake awareness and dancing emptiness. It's just dancing as awareness, which is not limited. It's connected everywhere. So you have to have that insight on some level first before you can call it one taste.
Is that because there is the risk of immersion in subtle energy as ground?
Yes.
But it's not?
But it's not. You can go either way. When you're in small mind, you can go to subtle mind, which is mindful witness, or you can go to subtle body. Each one is out of, you know, small self. So if you're
just— I see. And subtle body is the sense of like, there's just all this raw sensation and all these sense stores.
Cloud of sensations. Yeah. Cloud of sensations.
Yeah. Without— consciousness is a cloud of sensations. Yeah, and okay. So that's subtle body.
That's subtle body energy. Yeah. And that's what a lot of spiritualities try to, you know, chanting, mantra, a lot of yoga, energy practices are getting out of the mind. And all they are is that's a way, the same thing as mindfulness, which is more stepping up. That's just stepping down, but each are stepping out of to get relief from the small self. So they're both first moves.
So what I'm noticing is that, yeah, so I was doing the one taste thing from the level of subtle body energy. And so you're suggesting that there is an insight to be integrated in which the subtle body energy experience, this like cloud of sensation of like body and perception and sound, is seen to have the qualities of awareness itself.
That's right. Yeah. So one way to do that is to either go so far within the, you know, like within the atoms to the space of the energy within, or to go open up, you know, infinitely, or the other way to say it is, you know, go to the subtlest dimension, which is subtlest is prior to energy arising, almost like the quantum field. So I had a friend of mine who was a professor of physics at Stanford, and he was like, he loved to kind of explain all this, and I didn't understand half the math or any of that stuff, but he would say like, so I would ask him like, okay, so quantum potential, quantum field, what's it made of? And he'd say, nothing, but it has potential, but it's not made of anything. Okay, all right, I kind of get that. Okay, I get that feeling. So then what's a wave? Is that like first energy? No, it's nothing waving. And then he'd wave his hands. His hair was sticking up like this. You know, like, nothing waving. So it starts to be, potential comes into movement. And then the next stage, he said, then it becomes into particles and into planets and, you know, in patterns into forms like people and plants. But it's always has within it that essential consciousness that has potential. So, yeah, one of the traditional metaphors for the root word of emptiness in Sanskrit is svi, S-V-I. And the metaphor is the life force within a seed that helps it grow into a tree. So the invisible life force within a seed that helps it grow into a tree. So it's invisible, but it's intelligent. So that's awake awareness. So getting a feel for, without going into a deep samadhi, which is more like going into the night sky. It's going dark, deep within. This is kind of going day sky subtle until you feel that the primary dimension is aware of itself. So awareness of awareness is the practice. And, you know, it's not easy. And some people, when they get there, they stay there and try to set up camp as awareness of awareness. Then they try to look back, remaining as awareness, rather than coming into the same taste, which is the more embodied.
I'm curious if this is what you're pointing towards, and someone described this to me recently, actually another guest. They're talking about Vipassana practice and like looking at the smallest bits of experience possible, and that when you're noticing the impermanence or emptiness of them, they're like coming in and out of being. And so they exist sort of, you get the sense of them existing in superposition between like nothing and something. That appears to be the quality that you're pointing towards when you brought up the discussion with the physics professor and the field and the potentiality. Is that sort of like the direction of the insight?
So, you know, the other kind of little map of awakening is going from recognition, so that would be called recognition. So you become aware that things are coming and going, and almost you're aware that they're in superposition. The next stage is realization, where you're actually not labeling and not noting anything. You're actually, it's called non-particularizing, because you are it. You just feel like, well, I don't need to look at it. But if I did look at it, I could see it because I am it. And that's the big shift. You really kind of don't care. But if you wanted to look, you just feel it. You just feel like, yeah, right. Superposition. There's nothing. But you're in it looking at it.
That's good. Yeah, I'd love to be experiencing that more directly here, but yeah. I'm not sure it's going to happen now.
Yeah, it could, you know, it's, those are big moves. You know, I can give little tastes like that other of, you know, trying to get that pure awareness before you get the mixing of the awareness and the aliveness, the, you know, the unfolding or the...
So is that just awareness aware of itself?
That first is awareness aware of itself, which... is kind of a strange, you know, language way of saying it, because there's not a subject and object. It just is aware.
And it's like knowing.
Yeah. It's just knowing, because it's a type of knowing that we don't know we're knowing from. We think we know from thought, you know, by particularizing and labeling. And but this is what is knowing. It's like the lamp, like looking back at the lamp bulb, at the light bulb, that's already the light. You know, so you're the light is aware of the light. There's not very good metaphors for it. It's
no, so yeah, that's pretty clear to me. But then you also talk about there being particular qualities of it, right? That it's like, it's clear that it's not impacted by any of the contents. It's not tired, but it also just feels like it isn't anything really. I don't get any like positive valence or any like clear sense of freedom from noticing this property. It's just, it's nothing. And it's existentially nice in the sense that nothing can ever touch it, or it's unobjectifiable, or like my true nature is.
Yeah. I mean, at its pure form, and even if you go a little more pure, when you go really to pure awareness, if you go to this contentless, timeless, boundless, all of a sudden you will have moments of, you come back and go like, did something just happen? Like nothing happened. Like there's no recording because you went into nothing. So it's like not a jhana. Because it's pure awareness, there's no content. So there's no imprint on your memory. So it just goes, choo. And then if you got absorbed in that, that would be more of a nirva kalpa samadhi. But right at the edge, right there where awareness is aware of awareness, there's an alert that as you just right at the valence, where it's not looking back as a witness, but it feels like, oh, it's everywhere and nowhere and here, then there's a sense of freedom, invisible, alert, or intelligent, meaning knowing, self-knowing. It's a sense of non-worry, non-fear, non-pain, non-suffering. And then in order to get to kind of joy and bliss, and you got to come back to, but there's a freedom from suffering. It's free of suffering. The ultimate reality, the pure awareness, is free of suffering. Then for that which is free of suffering to be primary in a human form is about the closest you get to a human being free of suffering, because the human is never by itself free of suffering if it loops on itself, but the awakeness that's arising as a human is free of suffering because it's primary. As soon as it's primary, you don't need to label or look or change, or like the Zen stories kind of try to show this, like the awake adept is up on a cliff and all of a sudden a tiger comes, so he backs up and then he sees if he can climb down, and he grabs this bush, and the tiger is coming over the top, and the bush starts breaking, And then he sees it's a strawberry bush. And he takes a strawberry and he goes, so good. And then the bush drops, you know, and he falls. So it's just that not having the primacy of emotional or physical dominance of fear or anxiety. Now the mixing, now we'll come back to something I've noted you said a couple times, which is important, is when you go into the void, or when some people go to awake awareness, there is fear. So this is why much of my combining of psychology and awakening has come about, because I realized that those parts of us, you don't want to just dissociate from them or transcend them or try to spiritualize them away, like zap them with awareness. You're not real. You're just a story. You know, those are the things. You're just a story. You're just a belief. You're just coming and going. It's like, oh no, I'm not. I'm a pattern. you can push me down, but I'm coming back. It's not, some things will dissolve immediately, but not the trauma, not the root, even the root conditioning of normal human ignorance of patterning around the primacy of just survival and physical, emotional interpretations that formed at certain ages. So we call them subpersonalities or parts of us. Some of them are traumatized. Some of them are created this protective system, which are smart and judgmental or critical. But all those parts are trying in their own way to find connection and love. So even the critic, so that's one of the premises of this unique psychology and direct path, is that don't ignore the parts, don't kill the ego, don't think there is no ego. The ego is not your identity, but it is an ego function. There is an ego function, you need it, and there is a personality, you need to personality has different parts of it, and you need to be aware of it from your awake consciousness or your bodhicitta, your open-hearted awareness, your compassionate self with a capital S, or no self, awake consciousness that has love even more than acceptance, has some kind of unconditional love or compassion with a capital C. And then those parts will start to unburden themselves from their burden of what are you afraid of? So you meet those, you assume that, okay, whatever part of me that's afraid is likely to come up if I do that again. So I'll either find it now. Anyone in there afraid? You know, like, I'm just going to the kitchen to get some food. I'm going to be right back. And I'm doing it for the good of all of us. So are you on board with that or not? Maybe not. If you are, then let me do that. And then come
except
back.
The kitchen is one taste, yeah?
Yeah, the kitchen's one taste. That's right. Not a big menu, no.
Yeah.
So that, I'm just giving a quick overview of that psychology, which is so important. Because either way, that's why people don't stabilize awakening, is because they're ignoring or denying their humanity, and they've discovered that initial kensho, which is initial awakening. And then not only that, but there's a whole huge percentage that not only do they not stabilize, but they think they're stabilized, and then their teenage part comes up and starts acting out, and they get involved with sex and drugs of, you know, like power and abuse and money and all these teachers and people who have initial awakening. If they don't embody and do that, including, you know, you've heard so many, like, how does that happen? How could that happen?
What's coming up for me is enlightenment is the harmonization of the awakened perspective with the human level, which is very much this Locke Kelly Adyashanti Mukti. I think it comes from Dogen.
Yeah, Dogen has some of it. Yeah. And the Mahamudra and so many of the kind of gentle tantra, you know, like, uh-huh. Not full tantric, like, you know, woohoo, you know, tantra, but meaning everything's sacred. Everything's part of the grist for the mill. You don't need to go through the path, the Theravada path. Again, they're going different paths. That's renunciation. And then transformation is the next. Whereas this way goes the other way around. It goes like, no, include everything is fine. Recognize what's primary and then welcome everything. And then unburden it until clarity. Don't act out on it. Don't act in on it. Just welcome it from this new view.
So we've covered a lot so far. So there's a few things I'm interested in. One would be like a brief summary of the path as you've discussed it, in particular, if you could frame it in terms of like pointing out instructions. So that movement from ego identification to awake awareness, then there's this pointing out about awareness aware of itself and the quality of that integrating. And then there's also the one taste. So like I'm interested in that as well, just to start off, is what you would define enlightenment or nirvana as.
Yeah, I mean, I think a little bit of what I was just saying to start with a simple is, you know, this kind of stories or myths or myth understandings of like, oh, awakening is having no emotion. You know, being all beyond. Awakening is having no self or being a witness or being mindful of everything you do or being able to look so closely at everything, you know, that you see the nature of reality, because there's still that little sense that it's a person who's awakening. So the ego or the person doesn't awaken, but then the absence of a person, the no self, isn't the end of the journey. That's just the move out of the old apartment building. Then you're on the street still, you know, you got a big open, I don't know whether you're in the country or you're in the city, you got a big open space because you just moved out of the small little house you were in or the prison. Now you're free, but who are you or where are you, where from? So that feeling that the awareness that is free of pain and suffering, worry, fear, and shame is none other than the human being that feels fear, pain, shame, and it's welcome to arise until it doesn't. And there's the primary thing is to unconditionally love that imperfect human being. And that's the nature of the awareness, is it's unconditionally loving. So the last movement after one taste is what's called bodhicitta, or open-hearted awareness, or this feeling of being in your heart mind more than in your head mind or in your psychological mind. So that feeling that the awareness is primary and it's already awake, and as it comes into form, it becomes juicy, or more like, first it's like the sky, then it's like the ocean. So it has a flow to it. So then
is that the subtle body?
And then it will connect to the subtle body, but it sees the subtle body as itself. It sees it as the arising, the dancing emptiness, you know, kind of the play of consciousness that's made of the free awareness that as soon as it comes into form, it has friction. So it's going to cause heat and bumping into each other and pain, and it's going to perceive through the senses. So it's going to feel, oh, too hot, too cold, too much pain, too little pleasure. And that attempt to identify with pain, pleasure only on the level of physical is what causes that suffering. But when you're the awakeness that has no pain and no craving, it's literally feels okay. Is anything need to be pushed away? No. Anything need to be gotten to be okay? No. Then that's freedom. Then normal tantric pleasures, meaning if you're hungry, you're going to like, why not eat something you like? You know, you don't need to renounce all things, but you're aware of the addictive tendency to let the emotional, unconscious, conditioned body, mind, emotion, try to find happiness outside in some experience. And you just keep being aware of that and realize, oh, that's just conditioned, unconscious or conscious attempt that I tried before that became a habit, that now this awake consciousness, which is already happy and playful and, you know, creative. It's not just couch potato, join a monastery, live in a cave. It's in the midst of everyday life awakening that can let pain and struggle and unfolding of developmental growing up and waking up happen.
So the one thing I think I'm interested in getting a bit more clarity on is that facet of trouble and difficulty arising when awareness gets juicy, right? So awareness aware of itself can notice the qualities of its, you know, it's both transcendent and immanent. And so the contents never harm it. And so at the level of its no-thingness is not affected by contents. And so it's, that to me seems like an okayness that is a little bit, it's not an okayness, at least in my experience, that is the kind of okayness that I would like. It's a little bit like, yeah, I for sure see it, but I'd like it to be more okay.
Yeah, it is more okay. So just to say that that's only that first, the pure okayness, then the mixing of okayness is hard to describe.
Okay.
Because it's so okay. Because it's like, I mean, literally, I'm like, you guys would not believe this. Can you figure out why I'm trying to teach this stuff? Because you got to check this out, because it's ridiculous. If you could feel inside what my experience is now, you'd be thinking you're on drugs. It's like bliss and bliss, but like everything's okay. Like everything's, it's all okay. Things are not working out. You know, things are, you know, like it worked out. It didn't work out. It's okay. All right. So then, but then you have to show up and kind of figure it out. Like, okay, so then what do I do? I got to deal this. I got to call. Make a call about this, that thing got canceled, and then it, you're just in life and it doesn't magically get good outside, you know, it's just stuff happens, but you just show up because that's what you're doing.
So I'm definitely then still confused at some level that I don't know. So maybe we could spend the remaining amount of our time just really pragmatically, because it sounds like your experience is really good. Yeah, so, you know, so for the audience, what is your, I don't know, just let it rip on the pragmatics of, you know, really arriving at that level, assuming that someone is at witness protection program level or beyond that.
You know, again, there's different doorways, there's different learning types. So in some ways, what I've done is primarily take my own experience and then take the experience of close colleagues and students and keep getting feedback about what's working, what's not working. I'm very pragmatic. I'm like, is that working? Where are you getting caught? Why isn't that? This person's working for, that person's not working for. So what works for you? All right, let's find that. Let's try this, try that, try this. No, no, no. Oh, whoa. Okay, there we go. So the unique attempt to try to describe this is because it's almost like a developmental stage that isn't marked in philosophy and, you know, it's talked about in, but psychology a little bit, maybe Maslow and some others talk about it. And now there's some definition of it, but still the lack of how to, right? So even those who put it on the map, like Ken Wilber and, you know, people like that, it's like, okay, so then how? Well, go to the traditions that teach it, that teach this stuff. I'm trying to like have studied with a variety of teachers, teachings, and said, okay, but this has got to be available. If it's already inherent within each of us, if the awake consciousness is installed and is who we already are, then you don't need any. Why do we need? We need the technique and the technology and the basic map and the grounding for whatever the foundation is, similar to if you don't know how to read and write, then, and you never learn to read and write, you still have the potential to learn to read and write, but you need to know how to do it. You need to learn yourself, or someone's got to help you learn to read and write. But you have the potential to read and write in you. Even somebody who never went to school can learn when they're older, because that's our human potential. So that's the metaphor for me, is there's this inherent capability to learn this new operating system, which one of the main obstacles is we've developed the previous stage of conceptual thinking to such a degree that it's that which has gotten us to now see, oh, I'm reading about this stuff. It sounds really good. I kind of get it. It's what I want. But that conceptual thinking is the greatest obstacle to go beyond conceptual thinking. So you got to go beyond the conceptual thinker experientially. So that's mainly what I call my glimpse practices are about. So rather than long meditations or sitting for long periods of time, the sense is, if it's here already, can we just shift out of the current constellation into the other and include everything? And so that experiential movement in this style of more inquiry style or looking method rather than resting method, the awareness has to move itself. So the awake consciousness has to let go and either drop within and open up, or open up and then include everything, so that there's a realization or a knowing from this awareness-based knowings. So I've reversed engineered a lot of kind of traditional advanced practices, tried to make them simpler, tested them out, figured out where they go in the unfolding, and then, you know, I'm in the midst of continually recreating and updating a kind of path that helps people know them. So that, you know, the words are words which can't describe if you haven't had the experience. It's like describing the ocean to somebody who grew up in the mountains and never went to the ocean. So you got to find a way to get people into this experience. Yeah, so let me do a quick little, one of my shorter little inquiry practices, just since we're talking about this. So I try to use, what are the best pedagogical systems? How do we learn? What gets in the way? So first give people the sense of the map and what we're going to do. So tell you up front, so you don't need to even be surprised, and then we try to do it. So the premise is that this, as we've been talking about, this small constellation of consciousness, this ego center, this manager, this small self, is what we've learned to operate from. So it's just a part of us that has moved from an ego function to an ego identity, and the thinking is just looping on itself and creating a point of view that, when we identify with it, it primarily is interested in survival of physical and emotional. It's trying to create safety and function in the world. It's trying to solve a problem. It's trying to go like, well, what's wrong out there? What can I do? What's wrong in here? What do I do? How do I get more pleasure out there? How do I solve this problem? How do I solve that problem? So it's a little, you know, scanning for danger, scanning for opportunity. So that problem solver identity. So behind that and within is this other awake consciousness, which doesn't have to go through that point of view. It's already spacious and pervasive and alert and aware. So what if that problem solver could just relax and reveal the awareness, so not only are we aware of it, but we're aware from it, and we could feel what that's like. So here's a little series of inquiries that starts with a question that's words, so you could understand the words, and then I'm asking that you feel that the problem solver can relax and that your awareness senses or feels or looks to what's here and where you're where from. Yeah. So the simple inquiry is this. What's here now when there's no problem to solve? So just understanding that question. And then realize there's nothing to do, nothing to get, just now. So what's here when that problem solver relaxes? No problem to solve. And then just notice we don't have to go to thought to be alert. Don't have to go to sleep to rest. Just notice what is here, kind of alert awareness. And then just notice, what's it like to notice that awareness, and what's it like to rest as that awareness? And then what's it like as you rest as this awareness, where thoughts can come and go, but it's really just this awareness of itself. What's it like to be aware of, as, and then curious from the awareness, what's the relationship to energy, sensation, thought, feeling, and the world? When you're aware from without creating a problem solver or a point of view, what do you notice if everything's welcome and included?
It's awareness and its contents. There's not much else. I mean, there's a relaxing of the sense that there's a problem, and there's like a, you know, a down regulating in the ego function or its absence. I still notice some suffering. But it's awareness effortlessly awake to itself as well as content. And then I notice the sense of witness that I was able to let go of earlier. But it seems like there are parts now that have caught onto the game and are very much not interested in the move of surrendering the witness consciousness back into one taste.
Okay.
That's what I noticed.
Yeah. Yeah. So they're used to that position,
yeah,
of the witness. Yeah. So yeah, so then sometimes like when you say I notice some suffering, so that suffering is physical suffering, emotional suffering, or pain, which is the, you know, we certainly can use suffering for that, but that the awareness is aware of the suffering is actually the important relationship. The awake consciousness is aware of the suffering, so that suffering is not supposed to go away, like right away. It's supposed to actually have the capacity to be with that human suffering. So then it doesn't have to bounce. If you're able to be aware as you were from non-thought-based awareness and then suffering, and you're able to kind of come in as well as be out, that can kind of collapse the witness, because the witness, one of its things is it wants to kind of back away from the suffering. That's one of its protective views. Whereas if it stays open and realizes, oh, the suffering is made of the awareness and there's space around it. So it's not just collapsing into the suffering, but it feels the awareness is within the suffering, like an ocean of awareness that's arising as the wave of suffering, but it still has the ocean around it, sky above it, earth below it. So it stays open, but it's also right. Like the suffering is made of that. It's local awareness.
What happened for me is I got a sense of like resonance and it started to feel good, and then it went up and then popped.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. Beautiful.
So for me, this sounds like it's in the direction of non-resistance, where it seems like it's very possible to be in a witness state that is like resistant to content.
Yes, that's right. Because it's just observing. If
it's like embodied awake awareness.
Yeah. This is embodied awake awareness, which requires, that's why it requires such a great capacity and realization that that's who you are. That then it remains, even as the suffering kind of tries to magnetize you back to like collapse around it or create a protective defender against it, you can let all that happen, but you're not watching it from the rooftop. Yeah, you're feeling it like you're willing to what I call shake and bake. You kind of go like, okay, here we go, you know, but you realize it's not going to, because you're not a limited battery of the body, that suffering is bigger than your ego. So this is the dilemma of most people, is they're trying psychologically. So to manage it, you know, trauma or suffering, and they've got to kind of cut off and detach and live. I'm doing the best I can. I'm working really hard. I'm, you know, just, you know, like, oh, I felt it. I'll work on it a little bit. But the bigger thing is like only this capacity, that's why I call it a developmental stage. Only the awake consciousness that's embodied can bear what seems to be unbearable. If you're a sensitive human being, you're going to feel like, I can't ignore this. So you're going to either become, otherwise you become depressed, which means you just, it takes you over and you go into low energy, or you become anxious, or you act out with something like, you people should do things that I think you should do, you know, or you collapse into some state of mind, or you become a workaholic, or, you know, which is one of the favorite ones of our culture, or you go into the phone and social, you know, media and lose yourself in that world of some kind. Otherwise, this capacity, that meeting point that you're describing, is the meeting point of same taste. The awareness when it meets your body, and then it meets the suffering. And it's ocean and wave. So it remains like, okay, I'm not going away. I'm not stopping the suffering. The goal is to actually unconditionally love and not change the suffering initially, but to be curious. What's going on? I'm here. What's going on? Like that. Like, stay.
There's a lot of willingness.
Yes, a lot of willingness. But the willingness, if that's why this awake consciousness as not just neutral and detached, but as capacity and power is so important. And that's why that in the IFS system, they have, you know, you're identified with a part of you that is in pain. Then you ask that part for some space. Then you become aware of that part. Then you start to open up to this sense of self with a capital S. And then you start to ask, how do you feel now as self? How do you feel toward that part? So there's the relationship that's not observing and what feel like, do you feel, what's the distance between you and this part? Oh, there's no distance. Oh, but are you also separate? Yeah. But are you also within? Yeah. So is this part still really in pain? Yeah. And are you totally identified with it? No. Are you totally detached? No. So how do you feel toward it? Well, I love it. And then that's where that's the new reality of non-detachment, non-identification. In between is that love connection that's capital L, it's unconditional. It's not, you know, trying to feel positive thoughts toward your suffering or something.
Makes me think of like the shape of a bracket. You have the capital S self. It kind of goes down into being, and then the being pops back up at the part. So there's a sense of separateness, but then also the connection.
Yeah, that's a good, yeah, that's the thing, is it's got a, so there's the solution right there to the witness, right? So you go to the witness, you go like, can you ask the part for some space? Now, are you aware of it? Yes. Are you aware of being the self? Yes. As the self, how do you feel toward the part? Now, you could say, well, from here, I feel sorry for it. But like here, I feel we're the same. I feel compassion, connection, curiosity, care. So that's the embodied feeling of what changes everything.
And so what's the next pragmatic step once one is sort of settled in this the immediacy of awake awareness that is completely willing to be in and with, you know, suffering and also troubled parts.
It's like a developmental stage in that it starts with experiences like going to grade school, learning to read and write. You got to read and write, got to keep coming back and doing it. So the main practice is small glimpses many times a day, consistently over time. So it's the willingness, if you're going to develop this next natural stage of knowing and being from awake consciousness, open-hearted awareness, you're going to have to, the Tibetan word for meditation is often translated as familiarize. So you have to familiarize yourself with your no self self, and then from as the self, familiarize yourself with human experience. So it's an unfolding, it's a learning, it's a relating curiosity that, you know, finding which glimpses and which practices work for you that help support you through the transition is a lot of what, you know, I'm trying to create with this website and these books. And by the end of the year or beginning of next year, I should have an app out that has a whole series of similar programs and daily glimpses and things.
Very first Mahamudra app approved by Tulku Urgan, perhaps.
Well, I mean, I think he would, but I don't know if so the key to say about Mahamudra and this kind of thing is that Mahamudra is pre-Tibetan. So it's actually North Indian tradition that took it up, but it's prior to, so it's got writings and things that are available to the public. It doesn't have to be authorized by Tibetan practitioners. So that's the tradition I'm in more. I've studied with many, many teachers from many traditions, but I'm not associated or affiliated with any of them, the Tibetan traditions.
Yeah, I think I was just ribbing the kind of, the whole permission and the secrecy around pointing out instructions, which is understandable, but, you know, also the way that you do it is so incredible and apparently non-risky. I'm not sure if you run into like cases where people go off the rails from this stuff, but
No, I mean, I'm very, very conscious the way I developed it because I have equal training in psychology and meditation is to make it a trauma safe way to do it. And the strangest thing, which relates to kind of some of the taboos of the direct practice or that particular belief, is supposedly it's dangerous to do, whereas actually the research shows it's dangerous to go into a 5-day
Vipassana retreat.
Yeah. Because my colleague Willoughby Britton did a study on that and showed that a large percentage of people, because what you're doing is you're deconstructing the ego, and when you do that in 5 days, you deconstruct the ego defenses. And so you get flooded with unconscious material that's no longer defended against. So I'm only saying that in order to say that, strangely enough, what I do is I introduce you to the solution before you come back to the unconscious problems. So in other words, if you open to the capacity to be awake consciousness, which is has this capacity to be with trauma and whatever arises without being detached and without being identified or without creating this small self, which is too small for it, then you can start to heal and be with it. So, you know, I haven't found people in my retreats, and we go pretty deep pretty quickly, but, and we use IFS. So we bring up parts of people who have had, if they're willing to talk, they've had early trauma, but they, you know, do it slowly. And they usually have some support outside, like therapists and things.
As we're getting to the end here, one thing I'm also interested in touching base a little bit more on was my curiosity has piqued about what's true of your experience right now. You were describing the quality of it, but you know, as someone who has been oriented in practicing, you know, many small glimpses every day, these pointing out instructions throughout your life, what is your experience like now, and how's the well-being?
Yeah, the well-being as well. It's like a developmental stage. It takes some time. You get these amazing openings within it, but then the opening allows other stuff that needs healing to come up, you know, so then all of a sudden you get like, whoa, I forgot about that. You know, that thing I said, I'll deal with that later. Well, now's later. Here it comes. It's this unfolding experience, but staying with that primacy, eventually it like moves from being difficult to glimpse to being easier to glimpse to being able to almost do it anytime, anywhere, to being a little easier in easier situations, less easy in medium and less easy in difficult situations, to being the baseline and starting to kind of show up by itself. So just waking up in the morning, there it is. There's the new, and it feels like, you know, it's like a kid feels a certain way. We felt a certain way when we were kindergartners, and then we felt differently when we're in sixth grade or something. You just develop, you can play, you can run, you can play music or sport or something. You start to, so it's just everything's easier, and there's almost a flow. The feeling is, in my style, I haven't mentioned it, but it's like a flow consciousness or flow state. So what does that mean? That means that it isn't requiring stillness physically. You can use that as a way to meditate, or what I call marinate, where you become the awareness and marinate the meat, you know, the body and the mind. But the functionality is really the amazing thing, because I don't have to think about what I'm talking about. Feels like it just comes out, and there's a kind of a open-hearted feeling toward meeting a new person or something, and I can kind of pick up if they're like all in their head and they're angry or competitive, or they're like, and I'm like, okay, poor person is just suffering, but I'm not going to react or play the game. I'll just stay with them. So the feeling is, you know, very much like I think is possible for most of us. It does feel like the new normal is being much like vast. I feel vast and sense of well-being and interconnectedness with things that don't look, and yet very functionally not having to look to thought. So right now, if I stop talking, there's no thoughts on the screen in my mind. So I've basically trained automatic thinking to not be, I don't go to it. It's in the background. It's just gone in the background. It's happening in my brain. If you look, measured my brain, it would still be low-level automatic thoughts. Just like if you bring your awareness to the bottom of your left foot right now, you can feel the nerve endings and the sensations. But a minute ago, you weren't aware of it. It was happening. So that, it's like training that. It's like, okay, automatic thinking. I don't need to keep, what's that? What's that? What's that? What's that? What's that? What's that? Or get on the train or create a story around it. It's there. Implicit memory, all the conditioning is available. I know how to, I trust language. I can talk, but I don't need to think about thinking. So it's this other function, whole functional and felt sense ease. And, but for me, it's very joyous and energetic. For some people, it's very calm and they're very, hello, how are you? Nice to see you today. I'm just going to, my primary work today is making tea, you know, but for me, it's like, let's go, you know, like, I'm just like, let's play and do this and do that. And, you know, and still, you know, rest and try to balance, but I tend to be so enjoying everything. I've, you know, like a kid on the first day of summer vacation is sometimes what I say. It feels like, it just feels like, okay, I get to live this life. And stuff, you know, stuff happens and doesn't work out. And I'm good at this. I'm not good at that. I'm doing this whole app thing now. It's like, I have no idea what they're talking about. with the language, with the startup and the, you know, and the back end of the front end, the, you know, and I'm just like, my brain is strained from like, I don't know if I want to learn all this, but I think I have to learn all this. Okay, so I'll just show up. Like that world where a lot of people are like, oh, that's easy. And I had, I'll say one more thing. I had long COVID. So I got COVID. No. Yeah.
Sorry to hear that.
Yeah, thank you for that. Yeah. So I had a year and a half ago got COVID, and many of the symptoms, brain fog, but I'll just talk about the brain fog one. So brain fog is very real and it happens regularly, but it doesn't affect if I'm teaching or talking. It's like I'm operating from non-brain fog. But if I stop and I go do something or go to a meeting and I'm listening to somebody, all of a sudden it's like, it's like a battery on a smartphone just goes like from 90 to 60 to 30. It just pulls. Like everything goes.
If you have to focus on someone else.
Yeah, if I have to, or just kind of in between. My body is kind of doing that. It's something's affected, you know, just like somebody with, you know, and people are saying, well, can you heal it with your awareness? It's like, well, I'm trying to heal it with my awareness, but some people like old age, sickness, and death, you know, these things happen. So what are you going to do? So I'm like, I'm working with it. I'm doing all the things. I'm researching. I feel a little better about it in general, but it's also like, all right, there's people, I'm just aware of the things that are working well and not well. This is one that it's not going well in certain ways, but it's not making me suffer. You know, even the things that are, might be called, it's not painful, but it's disability. There's certain limited abilities from it. But it's just, what is the relationship to it? And I'm not Pollyannish about it. Some people hear me talk like, well, I don't let it, you know, rule me. And they're like, oh, well, you must be in denial about that. It's like, well, no, I feel it. You know, one part of me, talking about parts, one part of me thinks, this sucks, you know, but then the me is like, okay, I hear the part that I agree with you, the part that thinks it sucks. And, you know, then the rest of me is like, show up and live from the, you know, almost helps me live from the more primacy, because I almost have to, of the awake consciousness.
Amazing. It's been a lot of fun, Locke.
Yes.
I love this. I love your teachings and your path. It's so great. I think I'm very much shaped in the direction of this kind of practice and work. So yeah, thanks so much for sharing all this. It's been so much fun. I'm really glad we got to connect.
Yes, thank you. Really, really a joy. And, you know, all the best to you. And let me know how your journey unfolds.
Thanks for tuning in. If you found this episode valuable, you can help support the show by joining us on Patreon. Link in the description. There you'll be able to get access to additional benefits that aren't available publicly. And if you haven't already, you can subscribe to this show on YouTube or on your preferred podcasting platform by searching for Mew. A very special thanks as well to Alex Zhu, James Juniper, and the Preamble Windfall Foundation for your support of Mew. It's contributions like these that make this podcast possible. Thank you for your support.